mindfulness mode.
I mean cultivating friendships with people that you might actually fear.
Hey, Mindful Tribe, welcome to the show. Welcome to Mindfulness Mode again today. And today we're talking with an American philosopher. We're talking with a gentleman who has just published a book, and he's published over 30 books. So this is pretty routine for him, I suppose. We'll talk about that. His new book is called Raging Fire of Love. And he is a professor of philosophy at Ibn Haldun University in Istanbul, Turkey. He's held previous positions at quite a number of other universities. We'll talk about that. He's had an appointment at Oxford University, at the University of St. Andrews, Peking, University of Notre Dame. He's an author, editor, and co-author, like I said, of more than 30 books. I'm here today with Kelly James Clark. So Kelly, are you in mindfulness mode today?
I am in it, man. Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
That's good. It's great to talk to you, Kelly. So what does mindfulness mean to you, first of all?
Let me say two things. One is I think I practice mindfulness in a way that tries to make me mindful of other people. And I think we are kind of constituted biologically to be really mindful of ourselves and of our children. And I've set it as a discipline for me and over the past maybe 30 years to create disciplines that make me mindful of other people, people who are really different from me, people who are not in my tribe, that don't look the same as me and don't act and talk and in the case of the book, worship the same as me or believe the same as me.
Right. Well, you did you grow up Christian? That's what I understand.
Yeah, I grew up in a Christianity is my home. I will say that I became increasingly disaffected with Christianity and Christendom. I don't like the nationalism that we find in American Christianity. When I started as a believing Christian, I was pretty much a fundamentalist Protestant. And so I thought all Catholics were going to hell. And then I went to the University of Notre Dame, a famous Catholic university in the United States. And I met, this is part of my mindfulness journey towards respecting and valuing other people. I met these Catholics who seemed to be better Christians than I was. And it didn't fit my categories. And so my categories had to change. I just could no longer think that everyone who believed differently from me was going to hell. Now, it may not seem like a big jump for people, say people who are outside the Christian tradition, but it was a big jump for me at that time in my life. And I think it would be a big jump for a lot of Protestant evangelicals in the United States still today. But at least till then, I thought, but them Muslims, you know, they're at least we have somebody that's going to populate hell, or atheists, or the list could go on and on. And it would take many years before I was able to be way more inclusive, and in the end to begin to think that all people are supposed to be blessed by God, not just people who believe exactly the way I do.
Right. And then you became really interested in the Jewish religion and you started studying that. Is that right?
Yeah. What happened was I was on sabbatical at St. Andrews in Scotland, and I had some Jewish acquaintances, but I never had any Jewish friends. And in St. Andrews, I had my first Jewish friend, Stuart Shapiro, who was a philosopher at Ohio State University. And we would take walks together. And he did two things. One is he pressed me intellectually. He really pushed me to think about issues that I had never thought about before. And then I'll tell you one in particular, he pushed me to think about Christian intolerance. And I thought all Christians were like, you know, we're loving and kind. That's what Jesus is about, loving and kind. And well, Stewart's family had been on the receiving end of Christian kindness, and it wasn't always well received. And in fact, people were killed, disenfranchised, and killed throughout nearly from the beginning of Christianity. And so I began to study anti-Semitism in the Christian tradition, and it's embarrassing. And people that I admired, like Martin Luther, the great Protestant reformer who I had admired before, I read some of his anti-Semitic writings, and they were vicious, unbelievably vicious. And Hitler employed those to get Christians on his side in the anti-Semitism that led to the Holocaust. So I just began to look at the Christian tradition in a whole new way. And then I began to think that Christians really needed to cultivate the virtue of tolerance and respect and liberty for people who are different from them. But it all started with this one thing, and this would be my one big mindfulness tip. Become a friend with someone who's really different from you. I just at the center of everything that I do, I try to cultivate friendships, and cultivating friendships has been totally mind transforming for me. And I think that's the way it works for most people when we come to think about how we should honor and respect people who are different from us.
And so, as a result of all this, did you find that some of your Christian friends became alienated from you?
Oh yeah, I remember one time hearing from friends that that I didn't vote for a Republican candidate, and I think Christians can vote either way. I don't the current alignment now with Donald Trump, I don't understand at all, but the historically, I think there's nothing wrong with conservative Republican values. I think a Christian can go in that direction. I just am more in line with Democratic values, but I don't think either view is especially Christian or not. But I had many friends who thought when they heard I was a Democrat, a voted Democrat, that I wasn't a Christian. I couldn't be a Christian anymore. And then people became increasingly unhappy, although I would just mostly hear things behind my back that that I thought Catholics were okay, and then and even more when I began to think that even Muslims are okay, and really I have begun to think that everybody's okay, that we're all doing the best we can to figure out the way life goes in a world that's really kind of ambiguous. And my hope is that God understands the human condition, and the human condition is we don't have adequate information sometimes, and we definitely don't have adequate cognitive tools to grasp all of reality, and then to expect us to align our lives in relationship to all of reality.
And what about agnostics and atheists? Did you begin to embrace that as well, that idea?
Yeah, I've totally come to understand how someone could be an agnostic and an atheist. And I have, although I still align myself with the Christian tradition, I still wake up in the middle of the night sometimes and think that it just couldn't all be true, you know? And I think if we're reflective human beings, we just have some time in our life, or sometimes, or many times, and for philosophers, it should be a lot of the times we should just wake up and think, I have all of these beliefs about the nature of reality, God, ethics, politics, humanity. I have all these beliefs about it, but I'm here at this one time in human history, and 1,000 years ago, everyone believed really different things about those, and 2,000 years ago, other really different things. And I look around the world, and I meet people who believe other really different things, and you just say to yourself, "Oh, this is what I believe. Could it really all be true? But am I the one that stumbled on it?" Am I the only rational one? Anyway, I just don't think that's, I think I've come to think that human beings are all trying to do the best they can to figure out what life is really like. And given their circumstances, their time, their information, we have different sets of information, and we're going to come to different beliefs, and sometimes that's going to be agnosticism and atheism. And so I've come to respect atheism and agnosticism too, even though I was sure 40 years ago they were all going to hell,
Isn't
and
that
I was going
interesting?
to be happy about that. That's the other thing I was sure, that part of my enjoyment in heaven was going to be to watch these people be tormented eternally by God, and I just can't believe that anymore.
Wow, that's very interesting. So now you basically teach on compassion, tolerance, and peace, right? That's.
And I try to use academic projects that bring Muslims, Christians, and Jews together, and then we do exercises together to try to because so this is academic. I work with academics. I either work with professors or with usually with graduate students. And don't think because people are highly educated that they're not bigots, that they're not situated at a certain time and place, and that they're not tribal. And so we've had a lot of difficulties to overcome trying to bring Muslims, Christians, and Jews together. And you noted I was at Ibn Khaldun University. I have an appointment in the Middle East,
Yes.
and I try to do my projects in the Middle East. I had a $1 million grant that involved almost 40 Muslims, Christians, and Jews from around the world on randomness and providence. We had physicists and theologians and biologists and zoologists and philosophers, split evenly, Muslims, Christians, Jews. And we had Iranians and we had Israelis. And if you follow the conflict now, you know the conflict in Israel is partly between Israel and Iran. Iran is using Hamas as a proxy to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. So at our first meeting, we had Iranians on, two Iranians, I think, and they sat on one side of the room, and the Israelis sat on the other side of the room, and they each would whisper to each other, but they weren't talking to each other. By the end of the week, everybody was talking to everybody. The group was all mixed up. A lot of the exercises, the non-academic exercises we did, had broken down some barriers and built some bridges. And those are hard to do. It was a 3-year project, and we still had, by the end, there was still overt Islamophobia sometimes among members of our group, and overt anti-Semitism as part of the group. So after 3 years of being together and working really self-consciously towards building bridges, there was still damage being done at the end. It's just hard to do to build these bridges.
Well, that's incredible. After all that time, there still was. Wow. Well, let's talk about your book, Raging Fire of Love. Why did you call it that? Where did you come up with the name Raging Fire of Love?
I came up with it in the end, because for let me just give you two reasons. One is that a lot of the traditional understandings of love, and these are ones that are understandings by philosophers and theologians developed over 1,000 years in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, have taken the fire out of love. And so they think that God doesn't love us with any fire in his belly. This is how God loves us. He wills good things for us. That's what God does. So God wills and does good things. That's what God does. But God's feelings are all the same. He's always happy. He's always in a state of bliss. And if bad things happen to his people, if he looks down on the Holocaust, for example, he doesn't get upset. It doesn't bother him. There are no upsetting emotions in God. So God is just in this state. It was like a stoic state of bliss. like above everything that happened. So to me, they've taken the fire out of love, these philosophers and theologians. And by and large, I'm kind of agnostic about how God loves. I think people who think they've got God's nature figured out, well, those people really bother me. People who are sure of what God is like, I just think we can't be. So I just say, I don't know how God really loves us, but I do know this, the Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all want fire in our belly for other human beings. That's the way we are supposed to love. Humans are supposed to love. And I get it from the Song of Songs in the Hebrew Bible, which if some of your audience may or may not know, the Song of Songs is really an erotic love story. God is not mentioned. It's a book of the Hebrew Bible. It's accepted as canon by Jews and Christians. And God is not mentioned once. What's spoken about in there is the love story between a shepherd and a young woman. And it has really erotic images in there. And not, and erotic in the sense that sex is surely implied in there, but also erotic in that they each desire each other above everything. And their desire is to be with each other and to do good for each other. And so erotic can mean sex, but it can just be that we have desiring love. So if I have desiring love for you, then I want good things to happen to you. And if they don't, it hurts me.
Okay.
And I can desire your health. And if you're unhealthy, it hurts me if I have desiring love for you. So any kind of desiring love that we have somebody where I desire your good, and if you don't have it, then it bothers me. And I won't be happy until you're healthy.
So would it be strange if I read that and I didn't pick up that erotic tone?
You could not miss the erotic tone.
Okay.
What you could miss is that it has anything to do with God. That's the part you could miss. It is an erotic love poem. It'd be very hard to miss when you read it.
All right.
So here's what the early Hebrew thinkers had to do. Oh, this book is part of our Bible. It says nothing about God. And then, so how do we fit this in? They say, well, it's a metaphor of God's love for Israel and Israel's love for God. And it never, neither of those terms are ever mentioned in there. So they had to figure out a way to fit this in. And to me, so I picked this because I want, say, Christians, for example, to have the fire of love for Jews and Muslims, and not just think that, A, they can ignore them. I want them to have desiring love for people who are different from them.
But a lot of people would say that goes against Christianity, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Well, so my whole book is to say, oh, no, it doesn't.
Okay.
You're making a big mistake if you think Christianity allows you to just care for yourself or your kin or your community.
And so how is that received by Christians in the United States then?
Well, I haven't published it yet, so we'll see.
Oh, yeah, true.
We'll see what people say. I know it will make some people unhappy, but each of the three traditions, this is my point, each of the three traditions is clear that we're supposed to love the poor and the oppressed, the stranger, the orphan, the prisoner. The Quran goes beyond even the New Testament in this, that you're supposed to aspire to free your slaves, that's a good, that people are not to live as slaves. And that in the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, slavery is not denounced. It's assumed. And there's even a text in the New Testament where Paul tells the slave, don't escape, return to your master. And then he tells the master to treat him nicely, but he doesn't denounce slavery. And the Quran does, because people can't flourish as slaves. And then it goes, all of them go even further and tell us that we're supposed to have raging fire of love for our enemies. And that's the part, that's the hard part,
Yeah,
the
that
costly
is
part, the
tough.
risky part. And it's the part we're worst at. We're not too bad at loving people within our own traditions, within our community anyway, within our traditions. We're really bad at loving strangers and loving enemies. And I look at some of the psychological reasons why we're bad at it. I work in cognitive psychology. I work with psychologists, and I look at how fear drives us in, and that love is supposed to move us out, and why we're so bad at moving out in love, because fear is so powerful.
It's incredibly powerful. It takes over, doesn't it?
Yeah, it wins. Fear wins. Like it's just, unless we work really hard to cultivate the kind of mindfulness we need, and mindfulness like our heart mind that moves our heart minds, the raging fire. We need to think differently and we need to feel differently, and I think they go together. So I think we sort of need to think feel. So I work in Chinese philosophy, and they don't distinguish this. The place you think is your heart, and so it's heart mind that are operative here. When you're becoming mindful, what you're doing is moving your thoughts and your feelings, and you're moving them in a different direction.
Well, His Holiness the Dalai Lama commented on your book. How did that happen? I know that you've written a lot of books, and no doubt he reads a lot of books. Is there a connection there? Has he commented on any of your other books?
No, I doubt he had any idea who I was whatsoever. So, the Archbishop Desmond Tutu also commented on my books. Let me start with him, and then I'll move to the Dalai
Yeah,
Lama,
please do.
because I wrote a book published around 2010 called Abraham's Children: Muslim, Christian, Jewish Reflections on Compassion and Peace. And I asked the and that has five Muslims, five Christians, and five Jews writing from their own faith perspectives in defense of liberty and tolerance. So I asked the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, one of the women that wrote for my book has won some major peace prizes, not the Nobel Prize, but some major peace prizes. And so have other famous people, including winners of Nobel Peace Prizes. So she knew a woman who had won the Nobel Peace Prize. And she said, I bet she knows Archbishop Desmond Tutu's email address. So I contacted this Nobel Peace Prize winner and got Archbishop Desmond Tutu's email address. And I wrote to him, and he wrote back and he said, I'm really old now. This is a long book. I really like what you're doing. I really favor it, but I'm not sure I can do it. I'd like to do it. Let me think about it a little bit. And then he signed it, Love, Arch. So I got a letter from Arch, and
That's
he loves
hilarious.
me. And then but I wasn't sure at that, like, is this a joke? Love, Arch? So I wrote to his assistant, and she wrote back the same thing. No, he's old. He gets asked to do a lot of things. He won't be able to do this. Sorry. And I wrote back to her, and I sent the email I got from him. And I said, is this really from the Archbishop? Or is this a joke? And she says, nope, that's him. I guess he might do it. And then he ended up writing a blurb for the book. So I asked him this time around to write an introduction to this book. And he really liked it. And then he passed away. And I had most of the book done before he died. And we were in email conversation. And he had started working on a foreword, and so I had to get permission from his estate to use what we had. The Dalai Lama, I had a through my contacts, I knew someone who knew someone. I knew someone who knew the Dalai Lama, but that wasn't enough. I had to get to his assistant, and but so the person knew his assistant to get the book before the Dalai Lama's eyes, and. I wrote some things that I thought the Dalai Lama might want to use, and something he wrote, and the guy read the book, and he says the Dalai Lama really likes this, and he wrote his own. So completely shocked me that he completely disregarded everything that I had suggested for him, and he just wrote his own. That's my connection. I'm grateful. I'm sure he gets hundreds of requests, thousands of requests a year for this sort of thing.
I'm sure.
Anyway, it was a friend of a friend of a friend, and it worked. That was the nice thing, and it's a really nice introduction by the Dalai Lama. Very happy to get it.
Yeah. And how do you think having these two people's comments on the outside of your book will change the marketing of your book and how many eyes end up getting on that book?
Well, I hope it's a big help. As you noticed before, I've written a lot of books,
Yeah.
mostly unread. So I read one time that the average scholarly article in some journal was read by 1.47 people. And I'm thinking, well, my mom was one of my readers, so there's only about 0.47 left for anything else I wrote. And then, so we write these things, and we people in academics, and I've tried to reach a wider audience. I think that we have ideas that should reach a wider audience. So I wrote this book hoping it would reach a wider audience. I've done this with other books that I've written, and I'm not a bestseller. I do the best I can,
Yeah.
and I'm but I think this topic is so important that Muslim Christians and Jews learn to appropriate love within their traditions for people who are different from themselves, and that people come to understand their traditions in different and deeper ways. And I've had Muslims read what I wrote, and I've had some Muslim friends who told me that they learned a lot, both about Islam and about love in Islam, from my book. And I hope I get the same response from Christians. And I hope that, I hope that the Dalai Lama has written a book about love and other religious traditions, but I don't say anything about Buddhism or Hinduism or Chinese religions. I don't say anything about those, but there are lots of people in the world. All of us need to become better at loving people who are different from ourselves. So I hope it gets read, and I hope it inspires people to do this in their own traditions. And I hope what I everyone needs to do what they can to make the world a better place. My book isn't gonna, I've been working in the Middle East for a long time, and it didn't stop Israel and Palestine. And no one asks me who has any power, what do you think about Israel and Palestine? What could be done? And so I don't have overly inflated hopes for the book, but I do have some inflated hopes that getting the endorsements of the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu land it on the laps of people it wouldn't have landed otherwise.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm really interested in how it says when you go on Amazon and you read about your book, you say, "This is a story about me and my friends, Kirk, Jim, Nancy, Marianne, and Ted," and you go on to say some other names and so on. And that makes it sound like this is a very, very casual, easy, relaxing read about you. And then you go on and say, and about my encounters with the Hebrew Bible, me as a philosopher. I haven't read the book yet. I haven't had a chance to see it. But is it that kind of book that the common person can just pick it up and just really feel connected and understand the message that you're passing on?
Yeah, I tell the story. I tell what's going on in the book autobiographically. So, for example, when I write about Islam, I write about my first. When I s say what is Islam, I write about my first trip to Istanbul, and I write about how when I flew over Istanbul, you can see the old city. You can see these massive mosques at the high point of Istanbul, and then I went and visited them, and the mosques look more like castles than cathedrals. And the most castle-like mosque at the highest point of the hill was built by Mehmet the Conqueror, who was the first person to conquer Istanbul. And he built it on the site of a Christian church. And to me, it's more it more represented power than submission to Allah. And it looks, and it looking like a castle, it just looks intimidating and dominating. And there's a mosque next to it that's a little bit the same. And then you go down, you see the Hagia Sophia, which is a really old former Christian church, which is turned into a mosque. But then I went into the Blue Mosque, which is another old mosque right across the square from the Hagia Sophia. And I entered inside, and it felt peaceful. There are thousands of these blue tiles that are just with pictures of roses, just gorgeous. And it's peaceful. And the king, the caliph, the emperor, the leader, when he went in there, there's an entrance that only he could go in, which sounds like a lot of pride, but probably both pride and safety. But there was a bar there for the emperor, and he had to kneel down before he went into the mosque. Like, everyone's equal when you enter into this. And I went back, I had a film crew there, and we went back and they filmed it. And on Friday prayers, the Blue Mosque was completely full, thousands of people crammed in line and then praying in unison. And my other two friends were filming. Well, I was just standing there in the middle of the mosque. I felt like an idiot standing there as people were bending down and praying. And then, but I was so moved by the whole thing, I started bending down and praying with them as best I could. And people to the right and to the left of me were nice about it and helped me. And I'll just say one more thing. And then I got invited out to a meal with Muslims. And so they had a stranger in their home. I don't know Christians who would do that, just invite some visiting Muslim to their home for a meal. And then they went off to pray during the meal, and they went off to pray in their room. And that I asked them what they were doing in there, and they invited me in and let me watch. I was a odd spectator, but I did it anyway. And then I asked them what they were praying, and they said, well, five times a day we go into this room and we pray to Allah, the all compassionate, the all merciful. And they went through their prayers, and there were constant reminders of Allah, the all compassionate and the all merciful. Well, I was taught that all Islam wants to do is have people like do things and they'll get into heaven. So they just go and have rote prayers five times a day. And then they go to Friday prayer service and they give X percent of their income and they do it only so that they'll get into heaven. But I watched these people and I saw what they prayed. And what I saw was a mindfulness practice. What I saw was people five times a day reminding themselves, A, they are not God. And that the God that they're bowing down before is the all-compassionate and all-merciful. And they're supposed to become like that God. And so anyway, what I wrote about was how I moved physically from the top of Istanbul, from a castle, which confirmed my beliefs in Islam as a conquering religion, down into inside a mosque, where I was moved for the first time to see the beauty of Islam, and then into a home, but then inside people's hearts as they pray to God five times a day. And so I did the whole thing with a story about me, but I moved from the way Islam looks on the outside to moving into the heart of a believer. And I think I could, and I tell this story, and I tell these especially with Islam, because I think Christians need to learn that these are human beings worthy of honor and respect. Because I think we've so dehumanized people with brown skin, people who are Arabs, people who are Muslims, as violent terrorists, taxi driver, donkey rider. They're all sorts of ways that we look at them, and they need to begin to. I wanted to kind of create a friendship with the people that I knew and met in the book that I wrote.
Did you pursue that position in Istanbul as a prof, or did they were they searching for you, and did they, you know, seek you out?
They sought me out. I'm pretty well known in Turkey. I have books that have been translated into Turkish. Turkey is one of the few places in the Muslim majority world where you can have Jews, or not Jews, where you can have Israelis be part of projects. A lot of countries, Israelis either just aren't allowed, or they're like completely illegal to have Israelis. Iran, no Israelis can come in Iran. But in other places, they're sort of de facto banned. You just couldn't have Israelis come and be part of a conference or workshop. But so Turkey was a nice base for me. So I'd already done a lot of projects in Turkey. And they came to me. It's really an Islamist university where I'm at. And I'm not an Islamist. I'm not a Muslim. I don't think I'm the only non-Muslim there, but by and large, it's a place where young people come to learn about Islam and its how it might be woven into society in various ways.
And what are you? Are you a Christian?
Yeah, I'm not a. So Christianity is my home. I like Jesus a lot. Again, I'm not a big fan of Christianity or the church or Christendom. So, but I consider myself still a follower of Jesus. And I follow him in this way. I think that he follows, I think Jesus was a Jew who was following trying to be faithful to God's promise to Abraham, where God says, through you, Abraham, I think he meant Abraham's descendants, I aim to bless all the world. And so I see Jesus as someone not primarily trying to get people into the next life, although I think that's what Jesus believed in, but I think he was trying to bring blessing to the whole world, that everyone would flourish if they would show compassion towards the poor, the widow, the orphan, the oppressed, right. The stranger, and even the enemy.
And what about those who are not heterosexual, homosexuals?
Well, I myself think that Christianity needs a serious reform on this matter. And I've written about it, and it's funny you ask. I wrote during... when the Supreme Court in the U.S. was making decisions about gay marriage, mm-hmm. I used to write a blog for the Huffington Post, and I was writing why Christians should support gay marriage, and even if they disagreed with it, why they should support it. And basically, I'm a freedom person, so the freedom that Christians have to practice their religion in the United States is one they should extend to everybody. Muslims, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, but also to people who have different practices from them. And that means to gay people, trans people, that they should extend it. Because in countries where Christianity is not the majority and other religions are, Christians are persecuted. So they should be able to see what happens when a religion inflicts its own moral vision on all of society. What happens is people that are not in the majority get hurt.
Yes.
When Christians are not, Christianity actually is the most persecuted religion in the world. Christians are the most persecuted in Muslim majority countries, in China, and in other countries. So it's the most persecuted religion by far in the world. But Christians can't see that by trying to assert their spiritual and moral vision on the whole country, that affects people who are different from them. And it's not right. People should have the right to pursue their own moral visions. And I myself don't hold the traditional Christian view. I've I've come to think that it was a relic of a time when people were more moved by disgust and shame than by clear thought on these matters. And Christians are really pick, you know, really highly selective in the passages that they choose. So the same passages that tell you that the same Old Testament passages, which are that are pre-Christian. Jesus, by the way, never says a word about homosexuality, but the passages that Christians usually pick are Old Testament passages. But they skip the passages that say if your child disobeys you, you should kill him, or that if you should never mix wool and cotton. Christians don't care about that at all anymore. There are all sorts of proscriptions in there that they just ignore. But them gays, you know, they're going to take the world down. And so I think it's not the best way to read scripture. I think they shouldn't hold that view. But even if they do hold that view, they should want to live in a society that has maximal freedom, that lets people who are different from them live out their own way of life. And so I'll just mention this quickly. I was in Iran and I giving lectures, and I got boycotted at the end because evidently a conservative religious group in Iran read my blog posts, read my Facebook posts, and said that I was gay, that I reject the traditional biblical view of homosexuality, and that I support gay marriage. I also went and heard Benjamin Netanyahu speak, and I said he almost made me a believer when I heard him speak. I was invited to the president's conference one year, and I was 5 feet away from Netanyahu as he walked out. I sat between two Nobel Peace Prize winners, and I don't know how I got there, but anyway, there's Netanyahu giving this talk, and I said he almost made me a believer, and then I said, but, and then I went on to say to remind the people I was writing to about the injustice of the occupation, and they said I was a Zionist. I'm personal friends with Benjamin Netanyahu, and the list could go on, but evidently my life, they threatened my life. And I'd like to tell you that I'm brave and stood up to them, but no one told me. I didn't know. Like, they just canceled my lectures, and then my host got me on an airplane and out of the city. And all they did was offer it to me as a nice option. I got to see another beautiful city in Iran, which I recommend. Iran was awesome. But they had threatened my life, and it made all the newspapers. And there probably were 30 pictures of the protesters, of me, of people defending me, of people criticizing me over my view. And the main thing I think was my views of homosexuality. I think that's the main thing that really gets people going.
And are you gay?
I am not. I'm not gay. I'm happily married with three children, and but I'm happy to see gay couples who are happily married and have children. But I myself am not gay.
And do you fear for your life, knowing that you've ruffled so many feathers?
I have been other places where my life has been threatened, or where it's threatening for an American to be. I had to cancel a conference in Istanbul because we were having Israelis at the conference, and there was a national campaign against my conference, and I was told that if we had held it, there would have been violence. But I didn't hold it. We didn't meet, so I didn't feel threatened when I go back to Turkey. I'm told over and over again, if I do something in Turkey, please no Israelis. And so it's clear to me that there are lines I cannot cross, and it's way worse now. Like Muslim countries are really upset with Israel right now. So you couldn't possibly have a Israelis and ha in a Muslim majority country and have it happen in peace. I was told the same in Jordan. In Morocco, I went to a Denounce the USA protest. And I just wanted to see, this was after Trump had moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and basically it told Palestinians that we favor Israel. You're out of our favor. We want you out of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, even though Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of the four holiest sites in Islam, is in Jerusalem, and Muslims, the Palestinians had, and Israelis had agreed to share the capital, Trump's move signaled that Muslims weren't welcome in the capital. The future of Jerusalem was Israel. So Muslims all over the Muslim majority world had protests on Fridays for probably about a year. And I went to one of those, and I did not feel unsafe. They were mad at the USA, they were mad at Trump, but I didn't feel that they were mad at me. And I was expecting that they might be, but there were hundreds of people. I was right in the middle of the whole thing. There were hundreds of people. There were speeches against the USA, and I have found, and you don't understand it entirely, I have found Muslims to be unfailingly kind to me. I didn't meet the ones who wanted to kill me, so that I guess they weren't, but or would not have been. But when I meet them there, I figured out, and this will be no surprise to you probably, but it will be to lots of people, and it was to me, that Arabs, Muslims, Turks, they're all a lot like us. And they want to live in peace. They want better lives for their children. They want to raise. They want, the list could go on and on. They don't want to conquer the world. And given all the threats to peace that the United States has had over the past, and we invaded it, Iran, sorry, Iraq, and dropped all these bombs. But I've met Iraqis who still like us, and I don't get it exactly, but they're all nice to me.
Yeah, yesterday I was with a group of students, and there were Arabs, Muslims, Asians, all kinds of, it was a real mixed group. And I was telling them about this interview that I was going to be having with you and asking them, what questions should I ask you? And they were really fascinated with you and with your writings and so on. And so I've asked some of the questions already, but one of the questions was, how did you get to this point in time where you wrote this book, Enraging Fire of Love? Now, you've answered a lot of that already about how you got here, but what would you say to them as an answer to that question?
I would say this is how I got here. I didn't plan it. I'm at the end of my writing life, the end of my academic life. I didn't pl I never would have guessed this is where I'd be when I started, but this is how my world opened up. I became friends with Catholics, I became friends with Jews, and I became friends with Muslims, and they friended me. That's the difference didn't seem to bother them that much. They friended me. I think Christians are not good at being not tribal, and I think other groups are better at it. I think Christians are not good at listening. I think we're often in the preaching or telling mode. We're not good at listening, and I started off in the preaching and telling mode, and I had to. I didn't decide to switch, but I, through meeting people and becoming fascinated with their stories, I just began to listen more and talk less. And this would be my advice to anybody who's listening to this: have the courage to get out of your house, or out of your house of worship, and go to some other place, or go to your neighbor, because all of us have neighbors who are different, have different colored skin, or have different worship practices, or different socioeconomic status. Get out and walk down the street and just talk to your neighbor and create a friendship. I end the book with rituals of love, and I talk about how each of the traditions are trying to transform us from, they think we're not, all the traditions seem to think we're not really very good at love. And so we need to cultivate it. And so I talk about Muslim daily prayer, how that is supposed to orient us away from self and towards God and towards a God who is love. And then I talk about Shabbat, and I mostly do it autobiographically, how I went into a home with this friend, my friend Stuart, and how in Shabbat you invite not just your family if you're around, but you have members of your community that you're with, and so how that helps us learn to cultivate neighbor love and sharing a meal, sharing thoughts and prayer, sharing values. So that helps us take a step away from self towards cultivating love towards other people. And then the last chapter is hospitality, and I use Christianity there as an example. And I talk about hospitality as a virtue that's distinct from evangelism. And hospitality is a virtue throughout the whole Bible. And I talk about how you're supposed to invite people where you expect no reward. You invite them into your house. It's not covert evangelism. It's the creation of friendship, and how cultivating the virtue of hospitality moves us out again further from self to family to community, and then out to the world. We're supposed to invite the stranger into our home and to make them our friends. And I talk about how difficult each of those virtues is to cultivate, but how each of the traditions are transforming traditions, trying to get us from selfishness to love of people who are strangers and even enemies, and how it takes practice, practice, practice. But I view the genius of the hospitality part is that we're supposed to do it one friend at a time. And so each person, it's a long, slow process, and each person is supposed to do that. You don't need to do it to 100 people. I don't need to solve Israel and Palestine to be a person that is trying to bring peace to the world. I need to walk down the street and build a bridge between one person on my street or my family and their family. And if everyone does that, then I think we would find the world to be way more peaceful and our communities way more flourishing.
Yeah, I do too. I totally do. Kelly, I want to ask you a question about bullying, because I've worked in that field of bullying prevention for a long time. And I wonder if you have a story about bullying where mindfulness would have made a difference.
One of my first good friends in the Islamic community is a well-known philosopher, but he's on television a lot. And he's on television a lot because in Turkey, religion gets on television a lot. It's involved in a lot of conversations that they have, sometimes just religion, or sometimes it'll be on some other topic and they'll want a religious perspective on it. And so he's become a major media figure. He has millions of followers. And I thought it was opportune for me to become acquainted with him as I was trying to build bridges between Muslims, Christians, and Jews, because he was so, he had such an audience.
Yeah.
And then I went to a conference one time. I flew from the United States to Istanbul. I flew from Istanbul to the far east, almost to the, we were near the Syrian border. There were, in fact, there were like outposts built with big machine guns in case anybody invaded from Syria. And so I flew a long ways to give a talk. And he didn't come to my talk. He had given a talk the next day and he had gotten mad at some people. And so he didn't come to my talk. I flew along and I thought he was my friend. I thought, friends go to your talks when you go that far. But he came at the end, and then he gave a speech at the end that had nothing to do with my talk. He just denounced all the people he was mad at from the day before. And I turned to my best Muslim friend there. I said, what's he doing? What's he talking about? And he said, well, he's getting back at people from the day before. And then I just looked around and there were hundreds of people there. I was the only probably only non-Muslim, only non-Turk. There were hundreds of people there. I looked around and I could see people were rolling their eyes. And so I talked to a few more people and I just figured out there were other things. There were other clues. I figured out other things that he's a bully. And it's okay in some public forums to be a bully. Donald Trump is a bully. And some people like that. It's like, he looks like a strongman. And this guy is big and strong. He was a former weightlifting champion. And I just decided right then and there that I could never have anything to do with him again. And I had been really, through his social media, I was really tightly associated with him. And it just had to stop. It stopped immediately. I could not, because my goal isn't to get anyone to believe any one version of Islam, which is his. My goal is to bring Muslims together. Mm-hmm. I did a community building project in Indonesia one time, and I held a meeting with Muslims and Christians in Indonesia, and I had leaders from Nahdlatul Ulama and leaders from Muhammadiyah, the two biggest Muslims groups in the world. Indonesia is the most populous Muslim country in the world. So I had leaders from the two biggest Muslim groups in those countries, and we met, and I asked people to share their stories of persecution, of feeling like outsiders. And we went around a circle and shared. And some of these leaders started crying, these Muslim leaders. And I said, why? And like, what's going on? I turned to the person next to me, to translate. I says, what's going on? And it turns out those two leaders had never met.
Oh, wow.
And they hadn't realized that things that they do hurt, in-group things that they do hurt this other Muslim group. So I want to bring people together, even within traditions. We all assume they're all together. All Muslims are the same. And
right.
And I began to think, you know what? Not all Muslims are the same. And we need to build bridges there too. So I could not anymore identify with any single tradition in Islam. I want to bring Muslims together, and people can have their own voice and say what they want to say. I want to create a space where that can happen and people say what they want to say, and then we can still care for each other. So that's a place where this guy's kind of beyond mindfulness. I think he's really gotten sucked into being a media darling, but right. All of us need to cultivate humility and not bully people to believe or act the way we want them to. And I just don't abide that in projects that I do.
That is a powerful story. Wow, Kelly. I appreciate that. As we move forward in the interview, I want to ask you five quick answer questions. So just 30-second answers are perfect. The first one is this. Who is one person who has been a powerful mindfulness influence in your life?
Oh, and I have 30 seconds to answer. That's good. I'd say my friend Ennis Doko, Muslim, because I learned from him the power of, the five times a day prayer.
Is he a public figure?
He is in Turkey, but he's a young guy at the beginning of his career, and he's become my best Muslim friend.
And his name is Dennis. What's his last
name? Ennis. Ennis Doko.
Okay.
You won't find anything he wrote, but.
Right. Ennis Oko. My second question is about emotions and how mindfulness has helped you to deal with your emotions differently.
My mindfulness practices have transformed my thoughts in, as I said before, my heart mind. And that includes thoughts and emotions. Because I think, and this is the raging fire of love thing, I think we need to cultivate love for people who are different from us. And that means moving our emotions in a favorable direction towards people who are different. And it means giving up our fear and learning to overcome our fear with love.
My next question is about breathing. Do you have any thoughts any suggestions, ideas about breathing as it relates to mindfulness?
I do not. I'm not a, I'm too ADD. I've tried it. I know it's good for me, and I do it for a while, and then I'm off into something else. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, your book, Raging Fire of Love, I'm looking forward to reading it, is really going to make a mark. I know that. Are there any other books that you would recommend that are related to this topic?
Well, I recommend to everyone, this is even an easier book, and it's a very powerful book that I wrote with a Muslim and a Jew called Strangers, Neighbors, Friends, Muslim, Christian, Jewish Reflections on Compassion and Peace. And we each wrote three separate sections, completely separate. We don't respond to each other. We just write about compassion and peace from our own perspectives, and we each do it through narrative. And so especially the chapter by Aziz Abu Sara, who I hope people look up, is a Palestinian born and raised in Jerusalem. And he saw his brother, when he was 10 years old, he saw his brother taken away by the Israeli Defense Force. His brother was 19 and was in prison for 9 months. And his brother got out of prison and he died within a month from internal injuries. He had been tortured to death. And Aziz had become a young radical, and now he's a famous peace worker. He's in his 30s and has won several awards for peace. And it tells his story from radicalism to peace. And those chapters alone are worth reading. If you stick with it, my chapters aren't too bad. And then I have a Jewish co-author who wrote about compassion and peace from a Jewish perspective.
I see. Are there any apps that you would recommend that can help people with mindfulness?
I'm sorry. I don't have any apps that I use or recommend. Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, as we wrap up the interview, Kelly, I want to ask you if you have any final words of advice for our Mindful Tribe listeners.
Yeah, I would say if you want to, my main suggestion for improving mindfulness is cultivating friendship and cultivating friendships. And I'm trying to be different here from other people that you might interview. So this is going to seem more outer oriented, but I mean cultivating friendships, which is a real transformation of your heart mind. Because I mean cultivating friendships with people that you might actually fear or know nothing about. And my suggestion is that you increase your knowledge and change your heart to the raging fire of love.
Kelly, thank you so much for sharing all of your thoughts and ideas here on Mindfulness Mode. I really appreciate you being a guest today.
My pleasure, Bruce. I'll send you a copy as soon as I get one.
Thank you so much. All the best to you. Bye now.
All right. Take care.
Hey, Mindful Tribe. Thanks for joining us today. And I want to thank my sponsor, Athletic Greens. They have a product called AG1. And I can tell you that this is a terrific product. It contains 75 high quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source ingredients, and probiotics. Whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy free, or gluten free, this will work for you. It contains less than 1 gram of sugar, no GMOs, no nasty chemicals, no artificial ingredients. It supports better sleep and better alertness. Athletic Greens uses the best products based on the latest science, and it costs less than $3 a day. So here's a special offer for you, Mindful Tribe. Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/mindfulness. And with that, take what we've learned today to reach new heights of calm, focus, and happiness. Stay in the mode.